Madison at 1:30 p.m. and in Chicago at 7 p.m. In Sunday, I'll be speaking in Michigan in three cities, in Kalamazoo at 11 a.m., in Lansing at 2 p.m., and in Grand Rapids at 5:30 p.m. On Monday night, I'll be speaking at the Philadelphia Free Library at 7:30. And then on Wednesday, May 10th, I'll be speaking at Seattle Town Hall in Washington. On Friday, May 12th, I'll be speaking at the New School in New York City. You can go to our website, check all the details at democracynow.org. Then we're on to Oregon and California. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Thanks to Becca Staley and Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Jenna here from Pacific Underground, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders tell our stories and unpack the issues impacting our communities. Tune in this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m., where we're going to be talking about how the month of May is Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. While having an entire month is exciting for some, it's a complete eye roll for others. So tune in this Friday to hear the Pacific Underground crew unpack the complexity of the terms Asian and Pacific Islander and debate the benefits of having a Heritage Month all to ourselves. I personally could do without it. Again, that's Pacific Underground this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m. right here on 90.7 FM KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of screening of the documentary We the People 2.0 on Friday, May 12th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. We the People 2.0 tells the story of people across the United States who have faced decades of environmental assaults, such as oil trains, pipelines, and fracking, and what they are doing about it. There will be a panel discussion following the screening featuring Portland-based community rights and environmental activists. Again, that's Justice Within Reach on Friday, May 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at First Unitarian Church Elliott Chapel, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world. You cast your vote.
And good morning. Good morning, Portland and the world. We're positively revolting here this morning, as usual, at 8 o'clock on Friday mornings. I'm Lynn.
I'm Ani.
And this morning, we are just pleased as punch to have Michael Mead as our guest. Michael is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. He is the author of The Genius Myth, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, Water of Life, Initiation and Tempering of the Soul, which is edited with James Hillman and Robert Bly, of Rag and Bone Shop, of the Heart, maybe that one's the one. Anyway, editor of Crossroads, A Quest for Contemporary Rites of Passage, and Michael is the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, a nonprofit network of artists, activists, community builders that encourage greater understanding between diverse peoples. Michael and Mosaic Voices are going to host an event about answering the call of the soul in times of trouble and disorder. I don't know what makes you think this is necessary at this time, Michael.
Yeah, I don't know.
But thank you for thinking of it. It's going to be, let me just say first, it's going to be on May 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. That's a Friday. The First Congregational Church here in Portland, 1126 Southwest Park, and that's on our website now, and we'll put it on the Facebook page, too. So good morning.
Good morning to you both.
How are you doing in these crazy times?
Well, yesterday I was considering the irony of the fact that it was Beltane, and which in, you know, the traditional Celtic culture would be the day in between the two solstices when people would gather to protect, to do rituals and be together to protect each other and to encourage healing and growth. And so that's the kind of ancient story that was going on, or I was thinking about when the Republicans passed their so-called American health care bill through the House. And so the irony to me was this pretension that there's any kind of health care, you know, there's not health or care in the bill, and the distance from the ancient idea that people need to come together to help each other be protected and be healthy. On Beltane in Ireland, they used to put out all of the fires because people used to, you know, just have their hearth and their fire. But everything would go dark, and then they would relight all the fires from a single flame, as if to remind everybody that we're all connected to the flame of life. And I think those kind of things are what's so severely missing in this culture now, where the two major parties just want to fight about insurance and not even deal with the issues of people needing health protection and care. So it was the irony of that that got me so much yesterday.
You know, years and years and years ago, there's a Jungian society here in Portland, and I am very interested in astrology. They had a Jungian astrologer on, and she was talking about, quote, the age of Aquarius, that it was going to be the fight between the sort of detached mind and the heart. And boy,
yeah,
apparently that seems to have come to pass.
Yeah, well, I really think so. And of course, healthcare is like the most personal of public issues, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's the person that's at risk in all of this, and exactly what you said, this abstraction of ideas, the pretension that we all know is not true, that if you cut taxes on the rich, everybody else is going to get better. That mania persists as if the pre-existing condition of the culture is the lack of openness of the heart. You know, I think we're dealing with some kind of a cultural precondition, that somehow has to be gotten to. It's just shocking to watch them over and over again. And you know, I don't know how people can feel proud, because there was all this patting on the back of the legislators, feel proud to be taking health care and benefits away from other people. I don't understand, except two ways of looking at it, maybe. This utter arrogance and need to feel better than other people, you know. I mean, the obvious answer is to create some form of national health care like most civilized countries.
All first world countries, anyway.
Yeah, and then used it as a guide to help other countries. So then why? Why not do it? And it seems to me to be so similar to racism and misogyny, because that's mostly older white men that are wealthy that are denying other people the opportunities that they have. And so it must be a very, very deep insecurity, you know, functioning in all of these areas where other people have to be made poor and sick and diminished in order for some people to feel healthy and full, or pretend to be. And I guess the other thing that strikes me is a kind of creeping nihilism. You know, this kind of, two kinds of nihilism, really. One, which I think Trump exemplifies, get all you can, as if amassing stuff makes you a real person.
Because it's worked so well for him.
Yes, it's really working. And or the other direction, deconstruct and destroy anything that has structure or meaning, as if that's going to lead to something good. Both directions seem to me to be ultimately nihilistic. And so for me, it all goes back to the individual person. In other words, in a way, what they're saying is no person counts, you know, except if we deem that they count because they can pay for health care, or because, you know, they have some kind of a elite value. And I think it's a fight over the idea that each person counts, that each soul born counts. And so it's really the soul of the individual against these nihilistic ideas, I think.
Well, it almost seems to me like we've watched ethnic cleansing places. This is like class cleansing. Plus, we'll put racial things. Some senators was a congressman saying that, you know, like it's poor people's fault if they get sick. Things that I can't completely understand. But I was reading an article by George Lakoff, and you always talk about story. You know, and one of the things he's saying is that logic will not change this, that the progressives try to speak logically to people. And obviously logic will not change this. I've heard people interviewed about Trump's first 100 days, and they're like, well, you know, which were an abject failure.
Yeah.
In any rational mind's point of view, but that's not where people are coming from with this.
No, we need to get to the deeper narratives, and I'm serious. I think it's a fight over understanding the innate value of the individual soul. You know, Jimmy Kimmel having this big public, you know, breakdown in his heart breaking because he realizes that even though he's in the elite as a celebrity, wealthy white guy, so on, but that his son was born with a pre-existing condition that they wouldn't even be able to attend to if they didn't have the advantages of being part of the elite, and him getting an empathy for all those who are left out. That personal versus this abstract ideology of pretending to be better than other people and forcing others to submit to that notion. That's the battle. I think it's a difficult battle because people keep thinking there's some kind of collective idea, but both sides are stuck. They're just stuck, and I think they're gonna stay pretty much stuck. I think we are looking for a different narrative, and the necessity to wind up in an altered culture.
Well, the hero is dead, right? I mean, this is like the death throes to me of the hero narrative in life.
Well, in many ways,
Donald
yes.
Trump thinks he's, you know, I can do it all, and people are looking for some strange patriarchal figure to fix their lives, and that's dying a hard death at the moment.
Well, I think we are seeing, you know, almost the opposite of what we want. And that's somehow, sometimes how things change. You get the opposite, which reveals more clearly what is really longed for. And I think we're in a long struggle to get to the deeper longing of the souls, which of the human soul, which turns out to be inclusivity as part of it. And I think politically some of it's happening in local areas where people are starting to go to that congressman and say, you can't do this to us. I think there's value in all that. But I think it's a struggle also for big ideas. And to me, you know, one of the biggest ideas that resides in Western culture is that each person is unique and valuable because of that. Each person has a gift to bring to the world, and culture is here to cultivate the gifts inside each individual soul, not to give some people opportunity and to discourage or diminish or reject others. I think that fight is a serious fight. I noticed that they keep saying that if we go to socialized medicine or whatever they want to call it, people will lose the liberty and freedom of choosing a doctor.
I know. Or
what about the people who don't get to choose a doctor at all? It's just so pathetic.
I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Or you might have to wait some weeks to get a doctor. Well, since
that never happens now.
That's, I was going to say, since we don't have socialized medicine, I then am at a little bit of a miss to try to figure out why it takes me 4 months to get an appointment to see a specialist. You know, it seems like these conditions already exist, and that the excuses are just that, because people know what's good for us, right? And single payer healthcare, socialized medicine in some form. Certainly, the majority of people, when you call it something other than socialized medicine, which of course has had so many stories told about it, people are for single payer. You know, let's just have some universal health care, please. And yet, we have to, you know, that propaganda comes back at us about how inefficient that system would be, about how you know, how you would lose all these choices, and it's, as Lynn points out, we don't have them in the first place because many people don't have that access to that care to begin with. So, you know, you were just saying about how we people that kind of like logic, that kind of like to work with facts, seem confused by the fact that they don't seem to make a difference. And I wonder if we could just explore a little bit more about how facts don't change feelings, that we have to get into that deeper level to really have those communications with each other, because just coming up with a portfolio of facts doesn't drive change.
It's the same conclusion that the environmental activists have come to, the piling on the facts about the melting of the ice caps and all the other, you know, derivatives of climate change are actually not working, working less and less. And so, you know, ultimately the facts can never tell the whole story, because the whole story involves the unseen, which the hidden feelings, the deep longings. And so there has to be the narratives that get to the kind of the inside story of what's going on. And along with that, I think there needs to be a psychological education of Americans. In other words, the inability to see through the fraudulent pretenses of someone like Donald Trump, who has built his entire career on conning and, you know, and pretending and dissembling, the inability to see this, on the part of some people at least, the kind of false hope that someone like that could change and save your life is a psychological problem.
Yeah, it is.
And so another strange thing to me in America is people think education is restricted to schools. But one of the roles of culture is the constant education of everybody. And I think we're in, you know, an extended teachable moment where people we have to help each other, I guess, awaken more to the confusion and really this nihilistic collapse that is threatening everybody. And so, you know, this morning I'm trying to wake up from the shock of what they keep doing. And
it's
then
a pileup.
Yeah.
It's hard to, you know, at the beginning of this, everybody was very energized at the beginning of his reign. And now it's a pileup all the time. And I know that's a construction. I pretty much have an intuition that it's a construction on their part to keep throwing paint at the wall.
Well, that's one reason I call it nihilism. They don't really have anything else. You know, it's a battle for an empty kind of feeling. I mean, there really is a crisis of conscience on one level, but like you were saying, it's a crisis of the soul, because the soul is what connects people, and this is increasingly appearing soulless. Like right in front of people, you know, saying no, this is going to make things better, when in fact, you know, the facts say no, 24 or 30 million more people will be without insurance, which is not the right issue anyway. The real issue is without care, and so there's this battle for the care, what I'm calling the soul of the world and the care for the individual soul. Because those two things are connected. It's only when people realize how valuable each living soul is that people get the connection to the soul of the world. And from the environmental point of view, it's the soul of the world that I think the narrative is about. It's not about some objective view of forests or materials and supplies that can be, you know, exploited from the earth. It's the idea that this is the whole thing is a living soul that we are each part of, and each uniquely part of. I don't even know how to say it except to tell stories, and so the one story that I've found in all the cultures that I've studied is the idea that each soul is unique and valuable, and that's what I saw in Jimmy Kimmel's public, you know, plea. And that's what I think stands against nihilism. And this stuff looks to me like nihilism, like, you know, ruin and destroy anything that has beauty that would be connecting everybody. I don't know why. I guess sometimes that some people involved have lost their own connection to the soul.
I can't think of any other way to, I mean, I keep saying sociopaths, but that's one word, and that doesn't, you know, help us all get together. And then the pure isolation of this, too. That's the other thing, is that I have a friend on Facebook who's in Alaska who is so depressed about this, she was talking about on Facebook about suicide. And I think she's just totally isolated it. I mean, to me, this is a real time to have community.
Yeah, and community gathers around something deeper than the obvious. And usually it gathers around a wound, a loss. You know, those are the things that make people more soulful. And so I guess, you know, I'm always looking at it and saying, well, it's crisis opportunity. When someone shows you, you know, the worst face of things that reminds you of the more beautiful face of things. I assume that's the dynamic we're in. But boy, it really takes a struggle to keep finding the footing and finding oneself sense of presence when they seem to be sucking the oxygen out of the possibilities of community.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I think everybody really does have to help each other. I keep thinking of D.H. Lawrence's poem, Healing. I don't know if you know that poem.
I don't.
It goes something like, I'm not a mechanism, an assembly of various sections, and it's not because the mechanism is working wrongly that I am ill. I am ill because of wounds to the soul, to the deep emotional self, and the wounds to the soul take a long time to heal and require repentance. A long and difficult repentance, and a true realization of life's mistake, and the endless repetition of the same mistake, a mistake which mankind chooses to sanctify. I think it's something like that. In other words, they're sanctifying the mistake of rejecting people. They're applauding themselves and sanctifying a mistake. But anyway, I like where he begins. I'm not a mechanism. I'm not an assembly of various things. That's not why I'm ill. I'm ill because of wounds to the soul. And so the more we feel those wounds to the soul, the more, at least I'm imagining, we'll find ways to gather. And that's why I was thinking about Beltane, how people used to imagine that you have to come together every once in a while just to say, we are, you know, living people. We are the souls of the children of the earth, and we need protection, and we need care, and we need to remain connected to nature. I think we're going to have to rediscover how to do that and let the ideologues fight it out, because I think they're determined to go further down that road.
It's amazing, and the cruelty of it all gets to me. But in the meantime, I would just like to let people know, just in case you're just tuning in, that we're speaking with Michael Mead, poet, author, storyteller, psychologist, so many things.
Extraordinaire.
And
you just have to truncate that list.
This is, yes. I'm Lynn.
I'm Ani.
And if you would like to get in the conversation, you have a question or a comment for Michael, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. We can be found on Facebook at Positively Revolting. We can be found on the Twitter sphere at Positive Revolt. And you can, if you want to email us, we're at positiverevolting@gmail.com. But right now we're talking with Michael about, so can you talk a little bit about what's going to happen at, the event that Michael is going to be in town May 19th for an event called Answering the Call of the Soul in Times of Trouble and Disorder. Can you talk to folks a little bit about what that's going to be?
Yeah, so it goes back to a very old idea that in times of trouble, there's an acceleration of calling. So calling is that idea that a human being is on earth with a purpose. And it's not an old, proverb or whatever that was that says, many are called and few are chosen. I don't think it's that. I think everybody's called and everybody is chosen to be themselves, and that our job in life is to become our intended personality. In other words, there's an unfinished script inside people, a plot line that we came to live out and to learn about, and the old word for it was destiny, which comes from the stars, destiny of the stars. And we're here to live out a destiny. That's the point. Yes, we have to do it in a community, we have to do it in a culture, we have to do it at a historical moment. But we're each here to live out that story. And that's the real freedom. Freedom isn't having a bunch of material goods and being able to be in a gated community or in some resort or something, even though those things could be okay or not, I don't care. Freedom is the opportunity to become one's genuine self. And so the old notion was people have to live in collective ways, but there's also a call for each person, and we're here to answer that call. And so another old idea was when things get turbulent and troubled, there's an acceleration of calling, as if to say, if everything is orderly and peaceful, you might not fully awaken to the call, but as things seem to be less satisfying or even terrifying, the call intensifies. And so then what happens is when people individually respond to the call, they find themselves closer to the gifts that they brought to life. They begin to figure out how to give those gifts, and all of a sudden the chaos and the disorder is being altered because people are living authentically and more fully, and we have gifts to give to each other, and all of a sudden things begin to alter and change and maybe grow back towards a more healthy and wholesome condition.
And certainly things are turbulent, certainly things are confusing, and people are terrified. So as we are living in this state of trauma, it seems that people are given to start showing horizontal hostility, that we are fearful of each other. And I think that drives further alienation. One of the ways I'm seeing that is as we look at, well, forms of protest, as we look around, I'm seeing and hearing from friends and folks that maybe I don't actually know, but I hear from anyway. And there's a lot of demonizing of that person scares me. I can't go to this protest because people might be there that might do things that I might be afraid of. I can't go to the protest because cops will be there and I'm afraid of the cops. I can't go to the protest. I can't speak my mind because I'm going to be targeted by who knows who. And so I'm now afraid that people are becoming stunned and inactive because of this miasma, because of this disorder and terror. How do we get through that that numbing, that sort of protective, and I have heavy air quotes on that word, numbing, because I don't think that actually protects anyone. It adds to our alienation. How do we get through that and actually get people to engage in community and go past that fear into realizing that we are each other's allies?
Well, I think another big idea is that we're going through a collective initiation, that we're not trying to repair a situation, a historical situation. We're actually trying to create a new, which also could be very old ways, renewed of being together. And so for me, it goes back to the notion of ritual. In a way, a protest is a ritual. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a political ritual, in mm-hmm. a sense. And but I now think that we need to have ways of getting together before we go to the protest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've started thinking in terms of and doing workshops around the idea of agents of creation. And so that, yes, we may go to protest certain issues, but the bigger feeling and the bigger sense is there that we are agents of this, trying to create something more wholesome and inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to do that, we have to be connected before we go and risk we don't know what in public. And so I'm actually imagining a renewal of the notion and sense of being in community rituals together. And that means then, and this, addressing the fears directly, figuring out how to pronounce what the fear is, and if it requires discussion between people that have fears, between each other, somehow dealing with that. Or if it can't be dealt with directly in language, doing some ritual things to cleanse and to ground. I mean, you know, I don't know where to go with this.
It's big.
But people used to just get up and go, now I'm going to go out and change things. In other words, sometimes people have to ground themselves. And in working with African people, you know, they would have a song for everything. If you remember in South Africa, when in the battles with apartheid, the people would all get together and they'd start singing and they'd dance in place. And then they go singing, kind of halfway running, but singing and dancing as they went to the protest. And that gives a sense of, wait, we are the people. We're connected. We have rhythm because our feet are playing the earth like a drum. We're singing together. And our song means that we are harmonized and unified. And therefore, we're empowered. And so on. I think we're going to have to.
Well, Standing Rock was an example of that. What the people at Standing Rock did.
Yeah.
Was a huge example to I mean, they were not even calling themselves protesters anymore. They were water protectors. And I think that's another good frame to change is that it's all protest, because there's kind of a strange negative connotation to that.
Well, but it's something to be against as opposed to something to be for.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Creative changers, it's up to the people at the time, but that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And it's been, and I still thank all the people at Standing Rock. That was one of the huge successes that really happened there.
Yeah, and even though the issues move on and everything wasn't decided and people play games with it, you still take something with you. Even if you weren't there, you get more of a capacity for standing, and because you're standing for something. And I think that works both on the environmental side of things and on the social justice side of things. And then it was beautiful how a large number of battle veterans said, we're going to protect those people,
mm-hmm.
not on a basis of politics, on the basis of humanity. And all of a sudden you had a right before everybody, if people wanted to pay attention, a change from the soldier to the warrior, in the sense that the archetype of the warrior begins with protection. And so that was a beautiful thing. I really agree. And so it then turns more into a ritual that's connected to the water, connected to the earth, and then people finding ways to protect each other. And it doesn't solve everything in that moment, but we're still talking about it, and people are still feeling it. And so that, to me, is more like ritual. But I'm also thinking that this requires healing. The divisions are so big. You know, the divisions are being acted out by political people, but the divisions are deeper than that. They're old and they're big. And so we need water protectors and we need activated healers. And so while they battle it out over health care that doesn't have either health or care in it, there's an opportunity to bring together everybody's innate knowledge of healing, all of the ways of doing medicine where people can help each other. And that's what I've been experimenting with, is activating people as political activists, but also healers, keeping in mind the necessity of healing, because that's where we're going to wind up. We're going to have to keep healing each other and finding ways to heal the situation we're in. And in working for years in communities, you know, of violence, where violence was the issue we were trying to solve or help, we wound up using the slogan, healing is a revolutionary act.
Mm.
In a culture this divided, anything that heals is revolutionary. And then the word healing comes from whole. And so healing makes things whole. And even if it's only momentary, or it's brief, like Standing Rock, that wholeness people can carry with them and say, remember, there's a moment where people were standing together. Remember, there's a moment where we all felt some healing while they were fighting about denying people health care. I think that kind of thing is where I'm inclined to be going.
Absolutely.
Sounds a little more healthy, yes.
Healing is a revolutionary act. I'm taking that with me today. Let's go ahead and bring Jared into the conversation. Good morning, Jared. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you guys for having the show, as usual. And thanks, Michael. Man, I was thinking about you this morning. It was so crazy, and then all of a sudden you're on the radio.
I love it when that works.
It was awesome. And I was just wondering, like, I know it's like, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, one of the most healing things I find is when you do your drumming and your storytelling together. I don't know if that's even possible, but every time I catch some of that from you, it's like, it's a very healing experience. So if that's possible, man, I would really love to love some of that medicine right now, but... anyways, that's all I got. Just wondering if that's possible.
It's so. A little awkward on the radio on the phone, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right.
However,
well,
come on down Friday, May 19th.
Yeah, definitely.
to the First Congregational Church, where we Michael usually blows the roof right off the place.
Yeah. Oh, I'll plan on being there.
Yeah. That's
anyways, man.
That's what we'll be doing that night. There'll be stories and songs. I mean, that's how people used to do it. Say, my goodness, you know, something's gone wrong. I mean, look what they're doing now. Oh, you know, we've fallen off the path. We're lost now. And then, you know, reach for a song, reach for a rhythm, reach for a story to pull us back together. And then the inspiration comes back. Then we feel connected to each other, but also back on the ground of meaning. And maybe, thanks, Jared.
Hey, I love you, man.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
So we can't go into a whole drum and story thing, but what it made me think of is the old idea that says the soul is the source of all meaning. And so when the world seems to be meaning less and less, I mean, I watch the news reporting of these kind of political moves they're making, and it seems meaningless. After watching the report on the House bill, so-called bill, I had to run up to the store to get something, get out of my car, and I see a woman I kind of know, but she's lost so much weight, I'm not even sure if I know her, and I say hi, and before I can say anything else, she says, well, I survived my heart surgery, and I'm still here. And I said, oh, wow, yeah, you look like you're Bailey here. She said, I'm fighting to stay alive, and if I didn't have insurance, I wouldn't have had that operation, and I wouldn't even be here. And it was like, you can't separate the pain of people, the struggles that everybody feels right now. You cannot separate that from the need for people to support each other and be together. And as you said at the beginning, it's not going to be a bunch of facts that make it better for all of us. So we, you know, I embraced her and felt closer to her, even though I barely know her. But my own heart could have that same problem. I know that. And so we have to get ourselves into heartfelt circumstances and standing in the ground of story and I think revive the old ways of being together and have songs that we share that make us feel whole for the moment, and then people can find their individual inspirations, and we have to become agents of creation and go out and change this whole thing.
I this year I've had some pretty serious health issues, and my community and people giving me good thoughts. Somebody said to me, do you mind if I pray for you? And I said, well, just don't pray that I'm going to die. And you can, please, do whatever thought-wise thought thing you can.
Yeah.
And that is as way as powerful a medicine as any drug.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I agree completely. That is medicine.
Yeah.
And
the first of medicines.
The old Native American idea that everyone is born with medicine inside them. And the struggles in life are partially intended to break our hearts open so the medicine can come out. And so here's this woman who's really just flesh and bone at this point, very pale and very frail. And she said, I'm wondering if the operation on my heart was partially about opening my heart.
Hmm. I mean, I've heard people say that about heart surgery many a time.
Yeah. Yeah, she was saying, you know, basically having the realization. And one of the things I said, well, listen, I can't imagine what it all feels like and all, but I can imagine that it's hard to explain what's going on inside you to other people. And if it's helpful, I would just say this. When a person goes through a radical physical change, illness, even spurts of growth in young people, when a person gets separated from everybody else because they're sick or they're locked up for something or they had a nervous breakdown, the human psyche thinks it's an initiation underway. And when you survive it, there's supposed to be a bunch of people who understand that you've gone through a radical change and survived it, and there's supposed to be a celebration, not just for your survival, but the fact that you've become a new person, and that creates the opportunity for someone to say, and I think my heart is more open, and that creates the opportunity for everybody to open-heartedly hold that person, and all of a sudden, they are a new person in a different world, because death, in a sense, touched them, and they came out a bit more alive. And that reminds me of the old statement that when a person goes through a great ordeal or a great loss, I would say when a community goes through a great ordeal or a great loss, when a culture goes through a great ordeal or a great loss, it either comes out smaller or bigger. We either come out of this as a bigger culture with the genuine dream of life, we come out of this as people with a greater sense of community, or we will all come out as smaller people arguing over who's paying for what. So I think of it more and more as a collective initiation, and then going back to your comment about the health issues and all, the psyche doesn't see it simply as medical. It sees it as ordeals through which we either become smaller people or bigger people.
I want to remind people you are listening to Michael Mead here on Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And you can follow us along on the Twitterverse. You can find us there at Positive Revolt. You can also like our page on Facebook, Positively Revolting. And you can join us right now on the phone. Join in this conversation, 503-231-8187. 87 is the number to call, and we would love to have your thoughts this morning on healing our culture, healing ourselves, getting through this trauma, and all with talking to Michael Mead this morning, who is going to be coming to town. And again, Michael, can you tell us a little bit more about what you'll be doing at your appearance on the 19th?
Well, as Jared brought up, I'll be playing the drum and telling a story at the same time.
We love that when it happens.
Yeah, me too.
That's good.
I came upon it accidentally years ago, and I had no idea what I was doing. And I was doing it before I realized that it was a really old tradition that you find in the Celtic world, but the Native American world, but also in Africa and Siberia and many places, where it's not art per se, and it's certainly not performance. It's really finding a rhythm and letting the drum bring everybody into that rhythm. There was a heart specialist writing a book about heart rhythm and arrhythmia, and he came and watched what happened to the audience when I played the drum and told a story. And then he explained it all to me, that everybody falls into a similar rhythm. And all of a sudden, he says, that not only does the heart go into coherence, he said the rhythm simply can bring everybody into heart coherence. He also said most people in the modern world live with their heart out of coherence almost all the time, and now that's even more so because of all these disturbances, every day a new shock, and that throws the heart out of its rhythm. And so he discovered, by observing and studying what ancient people knew, was you need a rhythm to bring everybody together. And so I'll tell stories. And one just came to my mind, I'll tell it very quickly. Native American story. Everybody was fighting with each other. It's happened before. People were polarized. People were demonizing each other. And it was destroying the health of everybody. And no one knew what to do. They couldn't stop it. No one had the idea. And so someone said, well, wait a minute, what if we went to some of the oldest animals? And so they started to try and find the oldest animals, and then they realized the oldest one was that grandmother eagle that was in a cave somewhere. And so they made a pilgrimage to find the cave. They entered the cave. They found the grandmother eagle, and she was in there. And this was a long time ago when people and animals could talk together. And they said, hey, the people lost their minds. Everybody's fighting. They're fighting about health and making each other unhealthy. What do we do? And she said, well, you can't solve it at that level. The only way this can be solved is bringing everybody back into the rhythm And so she took her heart, and she gave her heart to those people, and they took her heart back, and they began to use that heartbeat to bring everybody together. And that's the origin of the big drum that Native people use when they want to pull all the tribes together, that big drum, which is also the heart of the oldest animal on the earth, which was the grandmother eagle.
That is lovely.
So there's storytelling with the drum.
Hope that worked for you, Jared.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and talk to Dottie. Good morning, Dottie. You're on the air.
Hi. I think we should talk about cannabis right now as a medicine for the people that not only provides grounding for us, it heals a lot of our physical, spiritual, emotional wounds, and it raises our consciousness. And right now, you know, we're in Oregon, we are smoking a lot of cannabis. Not only smoking it, we're eating it, we're juicing it, we're putting it on our bodies. You know, and now we've got Colorado, we've got California, we've got like 28 medical states. So to me, this is our medicine. It's very empowering. And I'd like to hear Michael's perspective on this.
All right. Thanks very much, Dottie.
Yeah.
Well, it's part of the, I think it's part of the rediscovery. So you have the Greek notion of apocalypsis, which doesn't mean the end of everything. It means collapse renewal. It means uncovering and discovering. And so cannabis is kind of, you know, it's a healing herb that people used to know about and use, and they're finding more ways to use it now. And it's kind of in a rediscovery. And so it's a good example of something coming straight up from the earth and altering the laws. I don't quite understand how it's all happening. I mean, everybody remembers trying to change the laws for many years and nothing would happen, and then it started to happen. It's kind of like the changes in the marriage laws that makes marriage more about the union of two souls than about, you know, everybody's gender identification. There are things happening that are the rediscovery or the discovery and the healing and the opening and the reconnection to nature and the nature's inside people that are happening at the same time as other things are stuck and getting more embattled. And so I applaud it. I think it's great. And, of course, there's many other plant medicines that are waiting to be understood and used more as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's an example of a changing relationship to plants and to nature. And it made me think of another, you know, odd thing, that in hospitals now they're experimenting again with using what is it when flesh is breaking down, what is it that starts to eat the rotten flesh?
Oh, the maggots.
They're bringing back maggots in the
hospitals. Leeches, yeah.
Because they discovered that maggots have a greater accuracy than anything that even you know, the beams of light or anything they can use. Maggots can separate living flesh from dead flesh more accurately than anything else. And so they're
have for centuries.
Yeah. And they're rediscovering how nature heals things. You know, at the same time that they're denying health care to people.
I know.
You have to look for, you know, the gifts, and you have to look for the healings in the midst of the disorder.
Well, and it's another reason that you have to be grounded and know who you are in the middle of this, of the kinds of contradictions that are going on right now.
Yeah.
Exactly. It seems to me.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and, excuse me, let's talk to Edith and squeeze on in here. Good morning, Edith. You're on the line.
Good morning. I want to thank you and celebrate you with giving two books and authors that confirm and go into more detail the truth of what you've been saying, Michael. The first one is saying that when there is a great catastrophe, loss, or disaster, people come out and cross the barriers of gender, race, class, or whatever, and help each other. If it's explosions or earthquakes or flooding or a war or terrorism act, that they are unselfishly risking their own lives altruistically for the greater good. And when they tell people later about the horrific experiences, often interviewers are surprised that they have this bright glow of their face, their eyes sparkling, they're more alive, and they have such joy about these horrific circumstances. And the joy is to transcend themselves and their perspectives, to be open, you know, heart broken open to the oneness, the healing that is a revealing that we're all connected and that we live to this higher ideal of who we are and what society can be. And always at the end of that, whoever seems to be in control tries to clamp down and oppress or shoot or whatever the caregivers and try to discourage people, but they never forget that there was a time when they crossed class, race, whatever barriers and found a greater truth to who they are and what society can be. And it transforms and uplifts us. And the second book and author is Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy, talking about the spiritual healing that is the revealing of our wholeness and our perfection. And she says, all of nature teaches God's love for man. And it's all about that reconnecting, that love, that unity of good that makes us courageous, that makes us honest truth tellers, resisting all the ways in which we might be divided and afraid, but instead replace that with love, gratitude, and truth. So I just want to say, others have said and can go into much more detail, how you are so right, Michael Mead, and thank you for saying it.
Thanks, Edith.
And we have, let's see if we can just squeeze Larry in. Larry, you have about 1 minute.
You got to be short and sweet.
Michael, I got a question. Every night on the corporate news, ABC, CBS, all of them, they have a formula. They feed us all this crap, and then at the end, every time, they have this emotional story about a young child with cancer or some guy saved somebody from a drown. I mean, every time it's the same, and I just was wondering, what is their angle? Is it just pure cynicism?
That's actually a great question to end on. Larry, thank you so much. Let's go ahead and give Michael a chance to talk about that, and we have just about 2 minutes left.
Well, I think it is cynical in many ways, and I think it's also derivative of the idea that facts and logic and rationality are the whole story, you know. So it makes me go back to the old Greek idea that you had logos, which was a human capacity and a power, you know, to know and to gather knowledge and gather facts. And so the logos is the reporting of the facts and the figures, and people like it. It's part of our life. It makes some sense somehow, but it can't tell the whole story. And so people used to know that a person had to be double-minded, and the other mind, which is just slipping in at the end, is the mythos, because mythos meant the narrative, not the logical. It meant the heartfelt, not the mind thought. Mm. It meant the deep connecting feelings and the universal sense of life, not the ideologies and the ideas that people pass back and forth. And so they can't deny it. They slip it in at the end, not realizing that in this point in history, we need more of the mythos than we do of the logos, not to diminish it or reject it. But we have lots of facts and figures. We become pretty good at that. We need the mythos, which brings everybody together, the narrative, the stories that open the heart and lead to healing. That's what I would say.
And that brings us to, again, you're appearing in town on May 19th at the First Congregational Church. And we have links to that on our Facebook page for folks that want more information about that. Answering the Call of the Soul in Times of Trouble and Disorder is the name of that talk. Michael, thank you once again
you
for
so
joining
much.
Us this morning on Positively Revolting.
Thank you both so much, and keep up the good work.
We look forward to seeing you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up this morning on KABU at 9 o'clock, Pacific Underground discusses the pros and cons of having an Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And Air Cascadia at 10, you'll have headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, Radio Geekly continues their series on gaming with a feature on card games. We want to thank each and every one of you KABU members for your generous support. You, in fact, make this all possible. If you are not a current member, you can take care of that right now and avoid the rush. Just go right now to KBOO.FM and click on donate. That rush is happening. Spring drive next week. We hope that you're a member already, but just go ahead, join us and support community radio KBOO.
Thanks. We'll see you next week, or hear you.
Oh.
Happy about the current political regime? Want to do something about it? Something social justice related? And how do you find out about these things? Portland Resistance Calendar lets you know about a lot of these happening in the Portland area for the next week. It's a weekly podcast. It's a blog. It's a calendar. It's a floor cleaner. It's updated on Fridays. Learn more at kboo.fm/resist.
KABU is a proud media sponsor of the Beaverton Symphony Orchestra's last concert of the season. The performances take place on May 19th and 21st at the VBC Grand Auditorium in Beaverton. They will perform Robert Schumann's first symphony, entitled Spring, as well as Emily Doolittle's composition Green Blue. Doolittle is the latest artist in the Beaverton Symphony Orchestra's Northwest Composers Project. Also, the Young Artist Concerto Competition winners will appear and showcase the young